The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
The Guardian.
Cheer up, everyone. It's Politics Weekly. I'm Legra Stratton. We may be in the midst of the worst economic crisis in living memory, with much of Europe teetering on the edge of bankruptcy and dark nights starting to draw in. But look on the bright side. On the horizon is months of build-up to a royal wedding. So could the government have picked a better time to find out how happy everyone is? Also this week, 6 months on from the general election, Labour have a new leader and are riding very high in the polls. But is it time for a radical rethink of the way that they elect their leaders? Shadow Chancellor Alan Johnson certainly seems to think so. Joining the fun this week, we have two titans of The Guardian's comment desk, Seamus Milne, and on the line, Madeleine Bunting. And alongside them, we have the director of a new think tank, the Movement for Happiness, Mark Williamson. Hello, all.
Hello.
Now, this week we learned that the government is poised to begin measuring the happiness and well-being of Britons. Statisticians will devise questions later this month, and we could all be sent surveys as early as next spring. Rather than relying purely on economic growth figures, the idea is to measure the country's prosperity in a more holistic way. Now, Mark, you are running something called the Movement for Happiness. You're going to have to explain it for us.
Certainly. Well, kind of as the name suggests, it's about a currently small but growing rapidly body of people who basically believe that, the measurement and understanding of our happiness and well-being is really important. So in fact, I should say we're delighted with the direction in which this week's announcement's moving. We are, to some extent, I guess, a think tank, but in fact, more than that, it's about trying to build a body of people, not just policymakers and people who are in the education system or in local authorities and so on, but people in their daily lives who care about this and actually think that, like this week's announcement suggests, happiness matters to us.
So what would an average day work for you at the Movement for Happiness?
So at the moment, we're building this movement. We have yet to launch publicly, if you like, but we've already got a few thousand people who've sort of signed up to be part of this. They come from 51 different countries at the latest count, so it's capturing some global interest. And what we're doing is pulling together all the greatest knowledge from our, I guess what you might call wisdom of the ages, but also bringing in the new science of happiness and positive psychology to try and understand what is it that really makes life fulfilling in the round. What can we do from a policy perspective? What can we do from a daily life sort of individual and community perspective to build better, happier lives? So over the next few months, we're going to be building a whole series of interactive online materials and building the movement, bringing on board high-profile people who buy into this idea and trying to help people make positive changes in their lives, in their homes, in their communities, in their workplaces.
Madeleine, in your home, to be welcomed?
I have really mixed feelings about this. To start off with, it's a form of utilitarianism. It's the greatest happiness of the greatest number, which, you know, Bentham would have been delighted to see arriving in the 21st century on the political agenda. But, you know, there are real problems about utilitarianism. Say, for example, people said seeing homeless people on the street makes them unhappy. What then do you do about homeless people? You could actually argue that it would be a good policy to take all the homeless beggars off the street, and people are all then much happier. If you put happiness at the kind of centre of policy or the centre of your objectives, you don't actually increase happiness, because we know from all the science that happiness is a byproduct. And of course, Mark knows that. It's a byproduct of aiming at other goals, such as strong families, close friendships, good, strong communities. So, you know, I think putting happiness as the goal, either in your own life or in terms of public policy, is really problematic. So that's where I'm worried. On the other hand, I do like the way that, you know, Professor Layard has consistently sort of challenged the value system in our culture under his kind of happiness work. And I think it's the right challenge, which is that a kind of materialistic, more and more money, more and more consumer goods will make you happy. It's a nonsense, and he knows it's a nonsense, and he's absolutely right to be saying it. So I'm kind of caught in the middle on this one.
Seamus?
Well, Madeleine's right about those qualifications, of course. But of course, there's lots of political issues about what kind of questions are asked and how, and that'll be highly politicised. But I think it is a positive trend.
Will it? The ONS is independent.
Well, yes, independence in public bodies. That's an interesting idea. I mean, I think that it is a positive thing because it's recognising that the economic measures of national income don't reflect well-being for lots of very obvious reasons. Or don't simply reflect well-being. First of all, is the distribution of that income, and, you know, GDP can rise, but it can become more and more unequally distributed, and that can lead to big social and well-being problems, but also, of course, there are many things which are external to the market which affect people's lives in a very direct way, like the environment, work-life balance, all those kind of things, which are not measured by normal national income statistics. So it's, I think it's a very positive thing to recognise that and try and measure it, but there's all sorts of problems about it too.
Madeleine, is the particular problem that the reason people are finding it slightly hard to swallow is that you have a government that is sort of hell-bent on reshaping the state and the economy, and people are losing their jobs?
Well, the timing of this couldn't be worse, really. And, you know, in some ways, Cameron sort of deserves a bit of credit for sticking to this commitment. You know, he raised the whole kind of well-being agenda, and I have to say, I much prefer the word well-being.
Me too.
To happiness. You know, I really don't think, and perhaps Mark can justify why they keep on using the word happiness, because that's a really tricky word to use. But anyway, I think Cameron can, to some extent, because he's really sort of hoisting his own petard here, it couldn't be a worse moment, really, to start measuring this. Perhaps he's hoping that, you know, it'll be dire next year, but by the time the next election comes around, he'll be able to point to kind of significant improvements. He could quietly have parked this one, as, you know, it was a sort of fanciful notion that he had in opposition back in 2005 when he was trying to establish a sort of new type of conservatism. But he's stuck with it, and I totally agree with Seamus that we do need better measures of sort of success and development. We need a better measure of progress, really, than just, you know, really crude economic statistics.
Go on then, Mark, justify happiness.
Certainly. Well, I mean, I must say I agree with almost all that's been said there in terms of the sort of rationale behind this. But I think the word happiness can be unhelpful. I'd agree with that in certain contexts, in that if by happiness people's interpretation of that means what you might think of as instantaneous pleasure, so the feeling of happiness due to a good day or an amusing joke, I think almost a better way of talking about it is in terms of our overall happiness. So that means, how do we feel about our lives, taking everything into account, our feelings about our past, how we are currently, our expectations and hope for the future, all the different domains of our life, how we feel about our inner lives, our families, our communities, our workplaces and so on. So when happiness means that, I think it is the right word, and crucially it's a word we use in our daily lives. It means something to people. Well-being is not a term you hear down the pub particularly.
You see, this is where I really disagree with you, Mark. I think that happiness is a word that has been completely sort of prostituted in consumer culture to mean very sort of hedonistic, you know, having fun type bubbly happiness. What most people actually really value is fulfillment and a sense of well-being. And I think one of your struggles, Mark, is going to be to get that word happiness rehabilitated. And, you know, that's quite a big challenge.
Well, I mean, we need, if we're serious about trying to, I think, invoke some of the sort of shift in values that I think would lead to a genuinely more fulfilled society, then I think we do need some phraseology that unites people around it. I take the point about happiness being seen by some as being perhaps simplistic, pleasurable, hedonistic in nature. But I think actually it still remains the best description of what we mean by life being good. Well-being has a very sort of health and medical sort of sound to it. And it's, of course, hugely useful and effectively what we mean by subjective well-being, which is what this announcement this week is all about. So our own feelings about how our life is against various different dimensions is effectively a policy sounding term for what we mean by happiness, how good our lives are in the round. So I absolutely take the point. I think it's something we're very conscious of. But at the end of the day, if you ask parents what they want for their children, if you ask people how they are in their lives, you're asking about how happy they are, how happy do they want their children to be. Those are the things that consistently come up for us. Those are the things that matter to people about how they feel about their lives.
I mean, in a way, whatever terminology you use, it's clearly a political idea whose time has come.
Absolutely.
In Europe, at least, in the political culture. I mean, it's, you know, Ed Miliband, when in his pitch to be Labour leader, made a lot of quality of life issues, which I think is the same kind of idea.
Yes.
Really, things that can't be mediated by the market and aren't, it can't be measured by crude GDP statistics. So I think it's part of a political debate, which is a very positive one for, you know, what politics is going to be in the near future. It's interesting that Sarkozy in France, who's, you know, again, different politically, that he's nailed his colours to this month as well.
Madeleine, are there results from the ONS survey that could be a problem for the government? Are there sort of findings that might eventually come out with fullness of time that might be sort of something that they can't actually devise policy for?
Well, I mean, that's a big, big question, because what we know is that the figures about subjective well-being have been pretty static for quite a while. And in some areas, which are really important to people's sense of subjective well-being, like trust, there's been real declines. So, you know, one of the reasons why this idea has kind of found its political time, has come of age, really, is because it reflects a deep sense of anxiety that the really kind of important constituent elements of well-being are actually kind of heading in the wrong direction. That strong communities, strong families, close friendships, you know, all of these are kind of, you know, there's a sense that these are being eroded and people don't have the time, the marriages are terribly unstable and long-term partnerships very difficult, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I'm very interested, actually, just to take it into a really controversial territory, which really intrigues me, is that on the Movement for Happiness's website, what they identify as really bringing you happiness is, you know, loving families, close friendships, and then they say having a spiritual dimension or a greater purpose to our lives. And, you know, this is a really interesting aspect of the happiness research, but quite what a government can do about that, a greater purpose to our lives, a spiritual dimension, you know, the decline of political ideology, religious faith, these big political and religious narratives about meaning and purpose, you know, have all crumbled, and that leaves people feeling a real sense of periodic or continual meaninglessness in their lives. You know, what's the point of anything? And, you know, quite how you tackle that kind of malaise, you know, I think is beyond even Sarkozy.
Well, it's definitely beyond Sarkozy, but it's a very positive fact that people are focusing on it, because it's about a rejection of a whole market-driven consumerist ideology which has grown up in the years of high neoliberalism, which has now crashed. And so I think it's very much the moment of this time that people are focusing on these issues. And of course, what Madeleine's saying is right. I mean, politicians can't exactly give people spiritual meaning, but wider social movements can.
And I think that's the really key point here, which is within this sort of topic, there are certain things that the government can potentially play a role in. And I think ultimately the objective of policy making here is to set a framework within which people can live more fulfilling lives. But there's some aspects, and I think Madeleine's picked up a good one here, which is the sense of the extent to which we have meaning and purpose in our lives. You know, the research shows consistently that is a very strong driver of people's sense of well-being, but it's very hard to legislate for. So, I mean, some of the areas that can be affected by government policy would be in the areas of education, in the areas of where arguably we want to see a more balanced view on what a successful education system produces. So children that are able to understand their own feelings, to have emotional resilience, to deal with what life throws at them, to realise that there's more to life than exam success in its own right, you know, to be valued for who they are as people rather than for the results they achieve. So we've seen some pioneering work in terms of introducing some of those themes into curriculums in certain schools around the UK. Similarly, in healthcare and promoting a sort of more holistic view of what healthcare should focus on. So in particularly, you know, addressing mental health issues more proactively. I mean, we've compared to the investment we make in physical health, the investment we make in mental health is absolutely shockingly low. And so I think that's another area where policy can make a difference. But Madeleine's absolutely right. You can't cover all of this. And that's why trying to inspire people to think and live in a different way through the idea of a movement is actually important.
I mean, the other thing we haven't discussed is equality. I mean, you know, societies in the Western world have become much, much more unequal. And that's, you know, there's clear evidence that that's also produced lower levels of contentment and greater social unhappiness. And of course, governments can do a lot about that.
Well, from aspirations of equality to focusing on one couple, the royal couple, over the next few months, we're going to have a lot of build up to this big wedding. Is it going to matter at a time of huge fiscal consolidation, as we say in the trade, that there's quite a lot of money being spent on a wedding? Seamus?
Well, it is extraordinary when you remember, for those of us who can remember, the last big royal wedding at a not very different kind of time. I mean, you know, 1981 was a period of social upheaval, riots, cutting, high unemployment, recession. And it was certainly used by the political establishment of the time to try and, you know, calm society and turn attention away from the very high level of social tension that there was at that time.
And are they doing that this time around?
Well, they're obviously going to try and do that again this time, and they may be a little bit successful, but I think, you know, it may divert people's attention a little bit, but in reality, we're going through such a difficult and grim period, and the economic stagnation that's coming is likely to last for such a long time. I think it's only going to be a blip.
Madeleine, are you
Well, I'm interested how Seamus phrases it, that the political class tried to use the marriage back in 1981. I mean, you know, this is one of the kind of enduring sort of puzzles, really, about the British people, is that they have this extraordinary kind of fairy tale projection onto the royal family. And despite, you know, 30 years of tragically dysfunctional relationships in that family, the fairy tale persists. And I'm not so sure it's the political classes sort of manipulate the attention. You know, the fact is that the British public still love following the travails of this family. And of course, it will be a huge focus, and you know, one feels desperately anxious for this young couple. Can they really kind of sustain being the object of the fairy tale? But I'm not sure it's politically manipulated. You know, it's one of the enduring myths of Britain, and we may rant and rail and find it deeply frustrating that the British public, by and large, are still fascinated. But that's the truth of it. And what's more, it's been exacerbated by the rise of celebrity culture. Kate Middleton knows exactly how all of this is working.
Yeah, I mean, there's a celebrity soap opera element to it, which obviously during the Diana years became even more absorbing for people. And there's the traditional aristocratic establishment, royal family ideology, which is also still around, although much weaker than it used to be. I mean, you know, if you look at the opinion poll figures, you know, the proportion of the population that is wants a republic, that is basically anti-royal family in a political way, has risen over time, although it's still a minority, it's a large minority. But I think there is a manipulation of it. I mean, you just look at the media coverage of the announcement, I mean, which was absolutely wall to wall. I mean, that's not something that happens just spontaneously. Nor is it a conspiracy, but it's a culture. It's a political culture and an establishment culture in this country, which is fostered.
Movement for Happiness must have some sort of, it's a social attitude. You must have some feeling about these things that, as both Madeline and Seamus say, are kind of moments when we as a society look and sort of project ourselves or don't project ourselves. I mean, does the Movement for Happiness have a sense of whether these intense focuses on couples that are, you know, be it Beckham and Posh or whatever, and that, and the sense how that plays in people's lives?
Well, I think it depends on the particular event, and I think that the feeling that it invokes. But I mean, in general, I agree with Seamus that many aspects of celebrity culture lead to you know, unhelpful focuses on things that arguably don't lead to more fulfilling lives, so the desire for celebrity being one of them in many cases. But, you know, it is absolutely possible that this wedding could bring people more together in their communities, could re-inspire a faith in marriage and a general sort of feeling of, you know, things being right in Britain. And I think that's positive. So, you know, the media will determine how this thing is perceived, and I hope it will be done in a positive way, and wish them all the best.
Madeline, I mean, if it makes people think that all is right in Britain, I think that will not be a positive thing.
Madeline, the front page of another newspaper this morning is saying, from Pitt to Palace, and is emphasising Catherine Middleton's background, and that some of her great-great-grandparents once worked down a mine, and that this is actually a wonderful story of social change, because you've got this upwardly socially mobile young woman who is now possibly future Queen of England. Do you buy that?
Well, do I buy it? I mean, inevitably, every aspect of her story will be analysed as sort of symbolic of all kinds of things. I mean, I'm still reeling from the fact that what hadn't been clear to me is that since leaving university, she hasn't really sort of pursued any job at all. Well, you know, perhaps she's clearly got the family money behind her to not have to. But, you know, in terms of a role model for young women, this is someone who has, by and large, waited for you know, Prince Charming to sweep her off her feet. This is as old-fashioned an image of modern womanhood as it's possible to have. So I find that astonishing. What also about the social mobility? Well, you know, some people have made a lot of money, and I find her story of kind of the sort of sudden ballooning of wealth from party equipment. You know, it's a really, really kind of interesting kind of tale of how some people have made it so big in the last few years. How can you make several million? I mean, the family fortune seems to be considerable from party equipment. This is a kind of, you know, the boom of the consumer culture in the kind of second half of the 20th century, and it's brought, you know, some people right up to the top.
If Kate Middleton's family is considered an example of social mobility, we really are in a fantasy world. I mean, she's from a very, very wealthy family, as Madeline points out.
Self-made money, Seamus.
Sure, but that's a long, long tradition in the British aristocracy and the British royal family. They've been marrying people from non-aristocratic backgrounds, reaching back into the Middle Ages. I mean, and of course, all aristocrats were so-called commoners once.
Well, before we go, we're going to have a quick look at some of the latest polling figures. The results make very happy reading for Labour's new leader, Ed Miliband. His party is up 10 points since May and are now level pegging with the Tories. You would think that that would be cause for cheer among the opposition, but no. Today's Times newspaper, God, we're quoting the Times an awful lot today, quotes Alan Johnson, the shadow chancellor, calling for a radical overhaul in the way the party elects its leader and a loosening of its ties with the trade unions, which, of course, elected Ed Miliband largely. What do you make of it, Seamus? I mean, this is the third disloyalty by Alan Johnson towards the new leader this week.
I think it's a very significant series of moves by Alan Johnson. There is a large part of the Labour Party that has not accepted the election result and Ed Miliband's leadership, and they're trying to use everything to undermine him. And that's not just the group around the Blairites, but others besides. And
who are they?
Some of the people who supported Ed Balls, I think, are also playing that role. And they've used a series of different things, for example, the controversy around Phil Willis, to try and mobilise against him. And in Alan Johnson's case, this is a straightforward defiance, repeated defiance on issue after issue. And Ed Miliband is going to have to reassert his authority pretty quickly, or this is going to run out of control.
What kind of things could he do?
I mean, the actual issue that Alan Johnson is raising is clearly nonsense. There's simply not the slightest possibility of the union link being broken. The trade unions will not accept any such thing. They have the votes at the party conference. It's not going to happen. So it's simply a provocation. And I think, Ed Miliband appointed Alan Johnson as a way of trying to build bridges with the Blairites. And that seems to be being slapped back in his face. So it's quite a tricky situation, I think.
Madeleine, is it also a problem because there is a perception across the political spectrum that Ed is elected by the unions?
Well, I think one of the problems, it was always going to be a tough challenge for Ed taking on the leadership. And, oppositions at this sort of point in the cycle, there's not much attention focused on them. So he's not got much kind of room to really kind of assert himself, define himself, take on the battles, which that is the best way a leader defines himself. That's how Blair was able to sort of project himself as a strong leader, because he orchestrated a number of set-piece battles. Will Ed, he does seem to be kind of moving into this a little bit slowly. And one would have thought he would have had a bit of time to get himself, to get himself into the job. So, one's really astonished as to why Johnson thinks that now is the right moment to start causing trouble. What can be a possible strategic plan here to destabilize a very new leader who's still trying to get his bearings and work out how he's going to fight the coalition? You do kind of feel, God, this is quite suicidal. Labour is kind of rising in the polls. This is quite a sort of good position for them to be in. They can just, keep on, harvesting the increasing sort of anxiety about the coalition government. Why spoil that story? I'm sort of staggered, really.
Seamus?
Well, I mean, I don't know whether this is Alan Johnson's idea, but there are certainly some quite powerful people in the Labour Party who hope that they can destabilise Ed Miliband enough to get rid of him during this Parliament.
And, seriously?
And replace him with another candidate, either their king over the water or someone else besides. I think that personally, they're wrong about that. I don't think that's going to happen. It's just a damaging thing to do. But I think Ed Miliband was elected without the support of the majority of, or first call support majority of the Parliamentary Labour Party, and that's a tricky situation to be in. So he's having to manoeuvre and tread carefully to try and build a clear majority and a controlling coalition. And that is going to take time, but I think he needs to now assert his authority pretty clearly.
What I find astonishing about the Labour Party is that they couldn't get it together to get rid of the leader that they many of them claimed they detested and didn't think was up to the job, Gordon Brown, for 18 months, 2 years prior to the general election. And yet now they seem prepared to destabilize and actually sort of prompt that kind of fratricidal war that they were so worried about if they'd got rid of Gordon Brown. What possible strategy is kind of favourable for Labour by trying to get rid of Ed Miliband? It's just causing the kind of...
There's also a wider ideological point that I think the Blairites in the Labour Party haven't yet accepted that their politics has been discredited. I mean, for example, Alan Johnson fixed on the issue of the 50% top rate of tax, which Ed Miliband's committed to keeping, and Johnson wanted to signal he was unhappy with in the medium to longer term. But of course, it's the single most popular thing that the last government did, and remains so in the opinion polls. So it just isn't connecting with real life. And that's the same issue about the mechanisms and, or the extent of the opposition to the current coalition's cuts programme. You know, there are a number of people in the Labour Party on the Blairite side who just do not want to oppose many of the cuts that the coalition's putting through, because they would have liked to have done them themselves. And that argument has to be taken on and won internally in the Labour Party so that the Labour Party can be an effective opposition.
Well, on that note, we're going to wrap it up. My thanks to our guests, Mark Williamson from the Movement for Happiness, Seamus Mill and Madeleine Bunting. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Lex Stratton. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk, and to download your free audiobook, head to guardian.co.uk/audible.